Hello and welcome to Firestarter, the UK's first social enterprise for podcasts in health. This is podcast number 2 and features a presentation by Stan Fekiakara, who runs a social enterprise in India. And he's talking about his experience of running his social enterprise and how you can develop a whole social infrastructure around a fair trade model. I'd like to particularly thank the Social Enterprise Coalition for allowing us to record at their Health and Social Care Forum. And now I'll hand you over to Stan.
What I'd like to share with you is my own little bit of personal history and the kind of work that we've been doing in India. But with this group, and apologies to some of you were there yesterday because a lot of this will be repeated, but I thought that this being a smaller group and more informal, we could spend more time on reflecting a little bit on what are the parallels or the similarities and dissimilarities between what we have done in India and what's happening here. And I don't know much about the health situation here except through secondhand and kind of repeat, but maybe that will open up some areas for discussion. And some of my own kind of reactions to what I've heard in the last couple of days about what's happening in the health sector within the UK. First and foremost, let me say that I've spent nearly my entire adult working life working with the indigenous people of India, who are called Adivasis, or the first people, the indigenous people, or the tribal people of the country. They are just 8% of the Indian population. Well, that's a hell of a lot of people because, you know, we are 1.3 billion people, so 8% of that, do your maths, it's a very large, we are probably larger than a few countries. The indigenous people of India are larger than some countries. And it's also the single largest indigenous population anywhere in the world, though it's less known than the Aboriginal people of Australia or the Native Americans, partly because the government of India does not like to admit that they are indigenous people. They prefer to call them tribal people or scheduled tribes, because to say indigenous means confers on them certain rights, which would predate the rights of other communities. So they like to say that everybody in India is indigenous. You could argue that, because where do you have a cutoff point? But the point that all of us who are working on this issue is of indigenous people's rights in India argue is that they had a lifestyle which was completely different from the rest of the Indian community. They had a lifestyle because their reaction to any invasion or onslaught from outside cultures was to retreat. And this was a community that had a lifestyle which today people who talk about conservation and climate change and who are concerned about the environment would actually hold this up as an example of how you could live a sustainable lifestyle. Because these are people who depended on the forest, on the land, but they come from a culture where they only took what was needed to survive. So there was nothing where they, so there's no question of them depleting the forests or the natural resources. A form of agriculture that they employed, which was known as shifting agriculture, where they would cultivate one plot of land and leave and then come back, and every year they would cultivate a different plot of land, which was denigrated and in fact made illegal some years ago in the country. It was only in the late 80s that people discovered that this was a very sustainable form of agriculture because they allowed their forest to reheal itself, as they called it, because they would never cultivate the same piece of land within a space of 10 years. So the land, the forest were always able to, and the land could always recover from agriculture. I'm giving you a little bit of this background because the issue that these people were faced with, the indigenous people were faced with, was that their way of life and their vision of the world was at loggerheads with what happened subsequently. I think their first conflict arose during the colonial period when the British came and saw the forests as a source of revenue. Whereas for them, the forest was a natural resource, it was a common property resource, and it was a source of livelihood. And the British, wanting the timber for the railway and the shipbuilding industry, declared with the stroke of one pen, probably in London, declared that this was all national property, the property of the Crown. And so with one stroke, the indigenous people of India lost one half of their livelihood. Subsequently, land titles started being given. We had the Permanent Act of Settlement, again, a relic, a gift from the colonial period, where land was settled and title was given to people. And during this process, the tribals who never felt that land could be owned, because land was a common property resource to be used by everybody and never to be owned, because we didn't create it, They never ever laid claim to the land. They never claimed the land as their own. And as a result, they got left out of this process of entitlement. And so through various historical processes, I won't go into the details, but this is just to give you some of the highlights. These people ended up being unskilled agricultural laborers or bonded laborers. I don't know if you're familiar with the term bonded laborers in India, which is a form of slavery. They ended up as almost like slave labor or unskilled agricultural laborers in land which was once their own. For the last 20 odd years, I have been working with my wife and a small team of us have been working in the Nilgiri Hills of Tamil Nadu in South India. And we've been working with tribal people. And when we started working there, we discovered that more than 90% of them had lost complete control of the land. Only about 10% of them had small pockets of land. And so we started by launching a land rights movement, a tribal land rights movement, where we reclaimed the land. The state and other powers to be, like the big tea plantations that came into our area, they all decided to call it a land grab movement. And we just called it a land reclamation movement, because we believe this land once belonged to them. And it was a movement which involved organizing people at the village level for them to understand what were the causes of poverty, why were they in the situation where they are, asking the question, how did we get here? Understanding that land was at the heart of the economy and that they had to get land back. And then giving them the confidence and the courage to actually take action, which meant giving them backup legal support, helping them to understand the law, and helping them to understand that they were within their rights to reclaim the land. And so land reclamation meant, 100 people, men, women, and children, would just go to a piece of land, take physical possession, put up huts within a matter of hours, clear the land, nicely plant it. When I look back now, and whenever I talk about this 20 years later, it seems like it's very simple. But believe me, it wasn't. You can imagine the kind of opposition. We had opposition from the government, both from the Forest Department and from the Revenue Department. We had opposition from the big tea companies, Unilever included. We had opposition from the big landowning communities. In fact, we had opposition from everybody because we were upsetting the status quo. I'm underlining this because it has some relevance to what we will be talking about here. Because I personally come from a background, from a very political background. I had my baptism by fire in the late 60s and early 70s when I was at university, and at a time when some of you might have been from that period would remember that the university was in a very exciting place. It was full of politics. We had the civil rights movements in the U.S. We had the students' revolution in France, and it was all about student power and youth power. And so you hardly attended classes. I mean, our real education took place under the trees and the lawns of our universities, where we were always organizing rallies and protests and strikes and always looking for a cause. And there was always a cause to be found. I mean, you just had to turn a stone and you find a cause, and that was good enough to have a strike and demand that something be done about it. But what this did to many of us was injected in us a kind of a virus for justice. And it's a virus that's never gone away. Not all the healthcare in the world, not all the tablet medicines in the world could kill that virus. It's something that grew and took over our lives. And this led to me at the ripe old age of 21, full of idealism and enthusiasm and almost arrogant self-confidence, believing that, we were the leaders of the revolution. And so we took off because it was all about identifying with the masses. And we turned our back on our middle-class backgrounds. And I went out to live in a small tribal village in the north of India, in a state which was then known as Bihar, which has now become called the Jharkhand, and a very, very remote tribal village. And I spent 4 years in this village. And we spent a time when we believed that, literally the revolution was around the corner. And it was going to happen in our lifetime, and we were going to see it. It's 30-odd years since then, and the revolution hasn't happened. People are as poor as they are. There's the same kind of exploitation. But changes have taken place, lots of changes. And being older and wiser now, I realize that revolution actually happens unnoticed. The real changes in the world have happened not, in a blast of fire and a bolt of lightning, but have happened very, very slowly, almost insidiously, without people realizing the changes that are taking place. And this we see at in a variety of ways. But going back to Gudalur, where I work, in the Nilgiri Hills, where Julie came and visited us as part of her unlimited tour last year, the tribal people started taking over the land, but then we realized that unless they planted the land, they could not secure their position, possession, because they did not have title. And if the land was fallow, somebody could take it away from them. Somebody more powerful, more organized, richer could take it away. And so we decided to help them plant the land. And this is where we took, you know, we made a very conscious decision to, on one hand, we were a lean, mean activist political organization group. And now we were straddling the more mainstream development world of actually raising funds, investing, helping people invest that money and start income generation projects and so on. But when we decided to plant the land, we planted tea. And we chose tea because this was the mainstream economy. It was only planted by rich people. So for an Adivasi to say there were he or she was a tea planter meant something socially and culturally. And it's something that gave an income right through the year. So for a variety of reasons, we decided to plant tea. We were ridiculed because nobody believed that, you know, Adivasis. I mean, this is a scientific crop. You know, it has a history, a whole history of colonial scientific research and study. And you need highly qualified managers to, you know, plant tea. And where were these people going to plant tea? And we've proved them wrong, happily proved the cynics and the skeptics wrong. I had a planter friend of mine who every time he saw me, you know, he used to really irritate me after some time. And if I saw him coming, I used to turn away and try to avoid him. Because his favorite form of greeting is, "Hey, Stan, how are the tea plants doing?" I don't know if any of you all have seen a tea estate or pictures of it. You know, they're all kept at sort of at 4 feet level, so pickers can pick them. But if you actually left the tea bush grow, it would become a tree bigger than that. It would just go up to 65 feet, 80 feet. If you let a tree, it go, and if you didn't pick it correctly. And so his favorite line of greeting was, "Hey, Stan, how is the tea trees going? Are the people using ladders to pick the tea?" You know, this is the kind of ridicule that we had to face. But now we have more than 1,600 families and more who have planted tea, all have their own small plots of land and tea. And this has broken their dependence on the local landowning community. Because now they can choose to go for labor when they want to, because they have an independent source of income. It changed the whole economic base. This again is important in the context of what we'll be discussing in the end about health, is that all other changes that took place in their lives emanated from this one fact that we changed the economic base. And we provided a fairly secure economic base. And so when we're talking about health provision or healthcare or education or any one of these services, if we take the economic context out of the picture and just talk about providing care, we'll find it very, very difficult to come up with a sustainable model. Because there are lots of the problems with people not being able to access care of any kind or access education or access any of the services is because of an economic base having been undermined in one form or the other. And so this is something that we have to bear in mind. And I think our success lay in the fact that we just didn't increase the incomes of a few individual families, you know, training some of them to be carpenters or training some of them to be drivers or training some of them to be tailors, which is the favorite kind of NGO approach. Because this is an approach that everybody is very happy about. You know, people are very, very happy when you do these kind of things, which is why I was a little concerned when you said earlier that both the conservatives and the labor are very happy with social enterprise. I'm always very wary when the establishment, both sides of the establishment, are comfortable with what we are doing, because we are probably then, you know, we have to ask our question whether we are reinforcing the status quo. And that's something I'd like to come back to at the end. But the point is that when we take up some of these economic activities that don't challenge the status quo, everybody's very happy. Because actually, we are contributing to the status quo by investing in these service, skills. And we are providing cheaper drivers and cheaper carpenters and cheaper tailors and, you know, cheaper skilled people to the economy without the beneficiaries of that economy, which are the people who invest, having themselves to invest in these services. The voluntary sector comes in and does that job for them. So everybody is very happy. We decided to challenge the status quo, and we believed in redistributive justice and said, rather than just be the sugar coating on the pie, you know, sprinkling a few nuts and sugar on the pie, but leaving the pie untouched, we said we want a piece of the pie. And the pie was the local agricultural economy rooted in tea. And that's what we decided to do. And this, but from the, when having planted tea, successfully having planted tea, and while we were going around from village to village helping people to plant tea, we discovered that in every village, practically every single day that we went out, we would see somebody lying in a veranda of the house, in their little hut. And if we ask what's happened, they'll say this person is waiting to die. And while it's very, you know, it's one side of it is very beautiful, their acceptance of death, their philosophical acceptance of death as a fact of life, and not, you know, making a big who and ha about it, and not, you know, trying to find, try to keep that person alive at all impossible odds. Well, on one hand, that was fine, and if the person was, you know, really elderly and had seen their grandchildren and had finished their lives, that was okay. It was a natural process. But the problem was that most of these people who were waiting to die were not old. Most of them were very young. And nearly all of them, very often, the vast majority of them were women. And were young women who were waiting to die because of a pregnancy-related complication. And then when we started looking around, we found that the infant mortality rate and maternal mortality rate in this community of about 25,000 people was 3 to 4 times the national average. And that practically every woman that we talked to and we encountered in any one of our meetings would have had at least 5 to 6 conceptions with only one, and if she was lucky, 2 living children. Every single family knew of at least, had experienced at least one close female relative, woman relative dying in childbirth or pregnancy-related complications. This for us was made more poignant because my wife, Mari, was pregnant with our third child. And we knew that none, not one of these women had to die. And the only reason they died was because they did not have access to healthcare, which we took for granted. And not just took for granted, we demanded as a right. We took it, it was unthinkable that she should not have all her shots and her checkups and antenatal care and see a doctor and be able to deliver safely in a hospital. And these women were dying simply because they did not have what we took for granted, like we drank water. And that was when we had to have this big debate of whether we should get involved in health or not. Neither of us had a health background. We didn't know where to begin. And secondly, it was a big departure from, you know, our tea planting we could justify because we're still protecting the land. But providing healthcare was a big departure from this radical leftist kind of thinking of changing the world. And now you're going to provide healthcare when it actually should be the government's responsibility. But when in one village called Tepakad, three young women between the age of 18 and 21 died of childbirth in the space of 1 month, we felt we could not anymore tell the people, wait till their revolution happens, wait till your tea plants grow and yield a lot of money, wait till you have enough money to afford healthcare. Till then, let your women and children die. There's nothing we can do about it. We felt we could not do that, and so we decided to get involved with health. And when I use the word health, I mean health. I don't mean illness. Because we realized that most of these women and children were dying not because of an illness. They were dying because they didn't have basic, they were not able to get even to reach the basic health standards in terms of nutrition. Nutrition has nothing to do with illness. It's to do with not having enough food to be healthy. And so one of the things that struck me yesterday at the conference was when they were talking about the whole, you know, the healthcare system you have here, and we talk about the NHS, and we talk about, it occurred to me yesterday that you're not actually talking about a healthcare system, you're talking about an illness care system. It has very little to do with health, and it has all to do with illness. And we have a whole industry called the health industry, which is actually an illness industry. And there's a lot of money to be made from illness. And which is why the people you are, the private sector, is jumping in there. They are not trying to be Mother Teresa or Florence Nightingale or anybody like that. They are jumping there because there's money to be made. So we were talking about health in terms of where people did not really have to accept, you know, they reach a situation where they don't have to die simply because they don't have the basics to live a healthy life. And so we started by training. We had 2 young doctors who joined us. They had 3 months before they went into their postgraduate studies. They just graduated. And they just got married. So we enticed them saying that, you know, we live in a very beautiful place. It's up in the hills and we have a wildlife sanctuary. We said, come and spend your honeymoon with us. That honeymoon lasted, they meant to be there for 3 months, but I think it was such a beautiful honeymoon, they stayed with us for 10 years. And Deva and Rupa, this young couple, set up what is considered a model of community health practice within the country. Sorry, with this, just a time, what time are we talking?
You're fine, you're okay for Indian time.
Yeah. So Deva and Rupa started going from village to village, training volunteers from the village in very, very primary healthcare, which was basically taking care of under fives and antenatals. That was the focus of our work because these were two groups who were highly vulnerable. I'm very proud and happy to say that through the efforts of these fantastic women, most of the health workers were women, who fought against incredible odds, because very often the village did not want this. They didn't realize they had other beliefs, they had other systems, and they would not access modern care. Against all these odds, these women, in village after village, managed to convince their community to actually seek health care. And as a result of that, 20 years later, we have an infant mortality and maternal mortality rate which is less, very far, far less than the national average. And today, if a woman should die of childbirth, it is a huge community issue. We spend hours discussing why, what went wrong, why did this woman die? Where did we miss it? Why didn't she get registered with the health workers? Wasn't she followed up? What happened? If an under five dies, it becomes a big issue. Now, we have moved from that phase of malnutrition and very primary causes of death to more sophisticated and more complicated problems. But we also have other issues which are public health issues, like tuberculosis has become a very, very serious problem. And I'm focusing a bit on our health aspect and our health work, because most of you are from the health bank, and the context of this meeting is in health. But tuberculosis has become a very big issue. And for us, the question is, do we approach it as a medical problem, for which we have, you know, directly observed therapy? You have the DUT, I don't know if you all are familiar with this, because you all may not be, because tuberculosis is not common here. But there is the thing that, you know, the WHO came up with this system where you actually have somebody in the village who makes sure that the person takes the tablet. But the problem with tuberculosis is that you start the treatment and within days you feel much better. And so the patient stops taking the rest of the medicine. And then it doesn't work. And they're infectious. They communicate the disease to others. And so you have this directly observed therapy where somebody actually makes sure that the tablet goes into your mouth and you swallow it. But we had to do that, there's no question. But we also know that the real problem, the real cause of tuberculosis is the fact that they have overcrowding in their houses. And they've moved from traditional thatched huts to concrete roofs, where the smoke from the fires, the cooking fires of the house, does not go out. And so there is a housing problem that actually causes furthers the problem of tuberculosis. And it's not purely a medical problem. And so unless we are tackling both, if we don't solve the housing problem, we are going to be giving tablets to every single tribal person there, because tuberculosis is not going to go away. No matter whatever you do, it is going to be a problem within the community. That's just one example. We are fortunate that we still haven't had an incident of HIV/AIDS within the community as yet. But a tremendous amount of work has been done in people understanding what HIV is all about. Again, there are a whole lot of issues, you know, cultural issues. Can you talk about sexual things in public, in a whole village, with everybody? Because we come from an Indian culture where we like to pretend that it doesn't happen. We are all, you know, we are all immaculately conceived. People don't actually have sex, you know, it just happens. Nobody wants to admit it. We come from that kind of culture. And do we actually talk about this in public? What do we do? There were all these issues. But we had to take it on, and we've had major, major discussions in all the villages, lots of training. And people are very aware. People are very aware of the risks and taking the precautions. So rather than wait for HIV to become a problem and then campaigning on ensuring that retroviral drugs are at an affordable cost, you try to see whether you can take the steps to ensure that it does not become a problem within the community. God forbid it does, but we at least can say that we tried our best. So we have this whole healthcare system that we started up, but we started as a community health program, preventive care. But when people in the villages coming and saying that, you know, if you had diarrhea, we tell you, listen, you know, boil your water or take this oral rehydration with salt and sugar and all these kind of things. But if people came and said, you know, I've got bronchitis or I've got an appendicitis problem or I have something else, it became very difficult for us to say, listen, we don't tackle those problems. You know, we tackle things like which are preventable. If you've got a problem, that's your problem. You deal with it. We can't do anything about it. Obviously, we couldn't say that. And we started getting pressurized to provide curative care. And we believe that this was the job of the state, of the government. And so we started trying to lobby with the government to make the government system work. And we found that we couldn't because we are fighting against vested interests and we are not powerful enough to challenge those vested interests. I won't go into the details of that. But after a long struggle of trying to make the government system work, we had to give up and admit defeat. And this was coupled with the people demanding that they wanted their own hospital. And here was radical left thinking kind of people. Isn't there a hospital? I mean, no, how much more reactionary can you get? And we, of course, refused to start a hospital. And it was a two-year debate, which now with hindsight, I say we happily lost because we gave up the idea. And we started a hospital, and I was the strongest opponent to the idea of a hospital. And then became the most ardent supporter of the idea of the hospital. Because I borrowed a leaf from the book of the Indian missionaries, you know, or rather the Western missionaries in India. Because the Christians are just 2% of the Indian population. But they are a very powerful 2% because until recently, they controlled all the health and education institutions in the country. And so the mainstream, the remaining 98%, needed them. They were providing a service that was badly needed by the rest of the community. And so we started wondering, what if we could come up with a hospital and provide a health service, a medical service to the community, which the rest of the community wanted, but was actually owned and controlled by the tribals? Would this address the power issue? And it was like a light bulb going off. And so he said, yeah, let's do that. Let's start a hospital. But the key to this would be two things. One, it had to be a center of excellence, because the other people should want it. Because if it was a third grade hospital, which none of the others wanted, the strategy is not going to work. Second was it had to be seen to be owned by the community. It was not these do-gooders who had come, you know, and providing a service to the community. It had to be owned by the community. And these two challenges were met. We were very fortunate that at that point of time, two doctors, a couple, a husband and wife team, highly qualified surgeon, she a gynecologist, both Indians, but having spent 11 years in the US. The only Indians I know who went to the US saying that they will come back to India and serve the poor. I mean, every Indian who goes to the West says that. Everyone I know, including all my family members. I've all said, we'll go back there, we'll make money, and then we'll come back and help our people. They are the only people I know who actually did it. He set himself a figure. The moment he achieved that figure in his bank account, he left that very day he left the US, came back to India and started looking for a place to set up a rural hospital, and heard about us and joined us. And they came and set up this fabulous hospital. But in order to make it be owned by the community, we did a few very interesting things, which will probably interest you all. One is, we said that the staff would all be tribal, other than the doctors. And so the nurses were picked up from the community and trained to be nurses. We trained them as nurses in-house. Now, they were all people, these were young women and a couple of men, who had only passed class 5, class 8. The most educated person had passed class, you know, had reached up to class 10, had not even passed high school. And we trained them as nurses. And everybody said, how can you? You know, because this is not legal. Because if you want to be a nurse, you have to go through nursing college and get a certificate and et cetera, and you should have passed a certain level. And they said, we have been accused of breaking the law. And when I speak at conferences like this, I'm preempting a question that you all may ask me. So weren't you breaking the law by asking, you know, training these people to be nurses? I'll proudly say that, yes, we did break the law, and proudly. Because if people didn't break the law at different points of history, we would probably have the entire world colonized by now by two or three major superpowers. We'd probably still have slavery all over the world. None of you women would be sitting here. You would not have the right to vote. And South Africa would still be under apartheid. So there are points of history, there are points of our lives where we have to have the courage to break what is supposed to be the law if it's not in the interest of the community. This was one such. There was no way the community could take control of their healthcare system if we did not break the law. Because the way the system was set up, there was no way for the next three generations, any tribal would be able to get to a level of education where they could be nurses or be in charge of a healthcare system. And so we broke the law. We are not fools. We are very cautious about it, so we don't call them nurses. We just call them health workers or health animators. We use other terms. So if anybody tries to take us on, we have our escape route. But that was one thing, that the community was in charge. And we have very interesting stories because we had a person who came to the hospital who came in there, and he was received by the girl who was the daughter of his former bonded laborer. And he could not accept the fact that she was going to stick a needle into him. And that he was going to put his life in her hands. He just couldn't accept it. And he says, no, I need the doctor to do it. And we said, no, you can go to another place then. If you want it, this is how it works. Another thing that we did is that it's changed now, but when we started, we didn't have any beds in the hospital. Because our tribal people used to be very uncomfortable sleeping on beds because they always slept on the floor. And we found people wouldn't sleep the whole night because they were scared of rolling off. And I'm sure you all know that hospital beds are much higher than normal beds because they're not built for the patients, they're built for the doctors and the medical team, so they don't have to bend. Doesn't matter that you have to be fairly athletic to climb up on some of these beds. And for the tribal people, it is impossible to think of sleeping on these high beds. So we had mattresses on the floor. So which is a big joke when anybody asks us, how many beds do you have in your hospital? And we say, none. And they say, what do you mean? They say, no, we have 25 mattresses. And the other advantage was it could then expand very easily to 35 or 40. We just move the mattresses a little closer together. The other thing about the hospital that we decided to ensure that it was seen as a tribal hospital and the Adivasi hospital is that the Adivasi community do not have a gender issue. Women, there isn't gender, there isn't a clear divide between men and women as it is in other societies, and definitely not like like the mainstream societies of India. So we didn't have separate male and female wards. Probably the only hospital in the world, I don't know here whether you have hospitals where you have wards in the hospital for both men and women. Till today, our wards are mixed because it's not a problem for the tribal people. And so we have a tribal man admitting his wife into the hospital and then discovering she has to sleep on a mattress 2 feet away from a tribal man. And he's horrified. And he says, no. And we've had people saying, offering to buy a bed, or offering, we've had the local planters offering to build another wing for us and fund it so that we look after we look after their people separately. And we've refused. I said, these are our terms. You take it or you find other sources. Part of the reason why we have done this is because I have found that a lot of things that are started for the poor, when they are successful, get hijacked by the rich. There are lots of services that are actually started for some of the poorest people, end up actually serving some of the richest people. And so we wanted to keep this as a service for the poor. And this is one way of eliminating the rich, more well-to-do people, because no rich person would ever want to submit to these conditions, and so they would seek other options. So the non-tribal people who come are, again, the poorest. As a result of all this, the hospital is seen very much as something belonging to the community. And when we first started, if a non-tribal wanted to be admitted, they had to go to the tribals in their village and the village organization at the village level and get a written recommendation from them, saying, this guy's all right, he hasn't screwed us too much, we can let him into hospital, the kind of thing. And all these, we have given up all this because now there isn't a need. We have established, there's been a change in the power relationship. We have established it. Our nurses are sought after. And things came to a complete kind of pinnacle when the government nurses went on strike in the government hospital. And we got a call from the government hospital the our nurses would come and staff the government hospital. And we're not nurses, remember? So it was a big question for us. Because politically, we were aligned with the nurses. You know, we were sympathized with them, and we would not want to, what's the word when, you know, you break a strike? There's some word for black something. Black legs. So we didn't want to be the black legs, you know, come in there and break the strike. But on the other hand, once we had spent one day in the government hospital, nobody could then accuse us of breaking the law. So with this big debate, and finally we talked to the nurses union and said, you know, this is the thing, what do you want us to do? They said, doesn't matter, you come for a day, doesn't matter, it's not going to affect our strike. You come in if you want to. But in the meantime, negotiations took place and they were able to resolve their strike. And so fortunately, we didn't have to have that Hobson's choice. But the point is, we did get a letter in writing from the government hospital asking us to send our nurses. So we have it on record that we are nurses, you know, we have nurses. I'm just mentioning all this because I'm saying, I want you all to realize that way beyond healthcare, we are talking about changing power relationships. I think it's very important to recognize that. And this is what our whole work has been. I'll move on from health and probably come back to it at the end. We got involved in many things, education, everything, lots of different things. Each of these are separate organizations that have been set up. But all these organizations are controlled by a community organization, which is a membership-based organization called the Adivasi Munnetra Sangam, or the AMS for short, which is a community, not just a community-led organization, it's a membership organization. We have 2,600 families who are members of this organization, and they control all these different institutions. And when I say control, I don't mean it, you know, I'm not talking about rhetoric. You know, we're not talking about we've empowered them because we consult them. You know, and there's, and to me, the most abused word in the voluntary sector is empowerment. You know, you do anything, you hold a conference for women and say we've empowered women because we took them to Beijing for the women's conference. So we've empowered these people and so on. And I always say that when people talk to me about empowering somebody, I say, don't tell me about who empowered. Tell me who lost power. Because I think we are wrong to think that power is an infinite commodity and that there's plenty of it to go around. So all of us can keep whatever power we have. Let's just give a little bit more power to the powerless, you know. But we don't in any way change our power base. I don't believe that actually happens. If somebody has to have power because they're powerless, somebody has to give up power. Because in any human relationship, power is a finite, is a very, very finite commodity. It's not infinite. And somebody has to give up power to somebody else has to get power. So when you talk about power, tell me who's lost it, who's got it. So we started all these organizations where the tribal people are completely in control. But, the tea planting program was our flagship. As I said, this is what underpinned everything. We also started, I forgot to mention that, and I should mention that on health before moving on, is one of the big issues that we had about starting a hospital was who'll pay for it? You know, because this would mean raising funds for the rest of life. As Accord was meant to be a catalytic organization, Accord was the organization we started all this work, it was meant to be a catalytic organization which would pull out after a few years, after starting a process of change, but you can't withdraw a hospital, you can't pull a hospital out, it's there for life. So who's going to fund it? And I don't know if you all are familiar with the with healthcare in India. The state does provide, but it's very limited. And so most of it is out of pocket expenses. People pay for their healthcare themselves. And so if you can't afford it, you don't get it. And you have a health insurance or a medical insurance program, but that's meant only for the rich, because all the insurance packages in the past used to cover exotic things like, you know, kidney transplant, heart bypass. And all these kind of things. They're not everyday problems like bronchitis or appendicitis and so on. The smaller things were not covered. And you paid very high premiums. But we used the strength of collective action and the strength of our numbers to bargain with an insurance company and negotiate an insurance product where it was very affordable, which had a much smaller cover, but very, very affordable by all the families, and which covered everyday ordinary things. And since we had our own hospital and our own healthcare system, we knew that we could pay for this. I mean, we could provide this care within this cost. And so now our average expenditure per person, per year, we did the study a few years ago, It was actually a study done by the, which was checked out by the World Bank. But now it was probably a little bit more. But when we did it a couple of years ago, it was 150 rupees per person was what we're spending per year. That's just around £2 a year was the cost of providing a three-tier healthcare thing. This nobody believed, including the World Bank. They said this is nonsense. It's not possible to provide this care at this amount of money. And so they actually, a World Bank team came to study our work. And we had this very arrogant, I'll hold my language, who came in and says that, just so arrogant, came in there and told us that this is all nonsense. Your figures are fudged. It's not true. And we'll prove you wrong by the end of the day. I said, fine, go ahead. He went around to all our villages, went to our sub-centers, went through the hospital, went through everything. And then came back and said, ha, you got a lot of hidden costs, which you are not accounted for. And I said, what are these hidden costs? Where are they? He says, your doctors, they work for 5,000 rupees a month, whereas they would normally in the market be paid 100 to 125,000 rupees for such a qualified surgeon. Your nurses are all from the community, and you all pay them only the wages of the community, which is 1,500, 2,000 rupees a month, whereas in the market, they'd be paid about 12 to 15,000 rupees a month. You have your sub-centers in houses which are huts which are built in the village, which cost you nothing, whereas in the market, you'd have to pay at least 5,000 rupees rent for each of those buildings, and on and on and on. And I said, hold on a minute. If I was a manager from a private sector and I was a chief executive of a private company, and I was able to get a doctor who cost 150,000 rupees, and I was willing to get him to pay, work for 5,000 rupees, you'd give me a bonus. You wouldn't say it was hidden cost. If I could get people to volunteer and give us a building free and put up a building, you would clap laurels on me and promote me. And so these are not hidden costs. We are able to do it at this cost because the community owns it. And it is in their interest to keep the cost low. Whereas it's in the interest of the illness industry to keep the cost high. It is not in their interest to keep it low, but it's in the interest of the community to keep it low. And so our insurance program is very, very interesting, that they all are insured. Now, the insurance company, we are one case where they said there is no moral hazard. So our claims just get cleared. We given all the claims and they just blindly send us a check back because they know it's not in our interest to overclaim. So they don't have to set in expensive methods to ensure that we don't overclaim. Because if they set in those expensive measures to ascertain that we do not overclaim, then we are actually paying for that as well. That's part of the premium cost. The cost of the premium is not just for the healthcare, but it's also for ensuring that we are not giving false claims or that we are not overcharging. And so having the community in control has lots and lots of impacts, which are often not seen and are often not by design. We can't design this impact, but it does happen.
That was part one of the presentation. Part two will be in next week's podcast. Well, thank you for listening. This was Firestarter, the UK's first podcast for social enterprises in health. And you can find more on our website at entrepreneurses.net. That's entrepreneurses.net. My name's been Dave Dawes, and the music's Fire Dance by DJ Booley through a Creative Commons license, which you can find out more on the website. Hope to see you next week. Bye.